Wisconsin's prisons hold more than 1,200 people aged 60 and older. That's as of December of 2016. Some prison reform advocates say that releasing some of those prisoners could be a good start to tackling problems of overcrowding, accommodating medical care needs, and the growing budget. While most states, including Wisconsin, have an early release program that allows elderly or severely ill prisoners to be released before their sentence is up, a new Journal Sentinel investigation finds those programs are not used very often. Gina Barton is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's law enforcement investigative reporter, author of the book Fatal Identity, and host of the Unsolved podcast. Gina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us a bit, Gina, about how this program, often called Compassionate Release, got started?
When they started this program in Wisconsin, one of the goals was to try to save money. Estimates were that the state could save millions and millions of dollars a year by letting out prisoners who were no risk to society because of their advanced age or health conditions.
And how many people are we talking about in Wisconsin prisons? And can you talk about the kind of conditions they might be in?
Right now we've got 1,200 people ages 60 and over in Wisconsin's prisons. And the Department of Corrections tells me that close to 400 of them have committed crimes other than homicide or sexual assault. So these are people who have not committed the most severe crimes in the first place, and they've done lots of time already on their prison sentences. Two really interesting examples I found were a woman named Nancy Ezel, who's serving time on a drug charge, who is in a wheelchair, uses oxygen, has had a mastectomy, takes 30 pills a day. She's got numerous serious health conditions. And then another guy was Paul Eccles, and he was involved in a shootout with a police officer back in the 90s, 1994. No one was killed in that gun battle. The police officer's arm was shattered, and Mr. Eccles himself was left legally blind and a quadriplegic.
And talk about Eccles' story. His family had tried to get him out on this compassionate release program. Can you talk about that story a little more?
Some of the issues with the compassionate release program, in fact, one of the biggest issues as it's used here in Wisconsin, is that people like Nancy Ezel and Paul Eccles, who were sentenced before Truth in Sentencing took effect in 1999, is that they can't even apply. So they need to just try and get parole and hope that the parole board will consider their health conditions. The Department of Corrections tells me the parole chairman can grant parole for people like this at any time if they choose to, but I was unable to find very many instances when they did. And so when Paul Eccles got into this shootout with police, the police officer shot back at him, and all of these injuries took place in 1994. So by the time he made his first court appearance, the state had already spent $200,000 on his care, and in fact, his first court appearance occurred in his hospital room. Needless to say, his condition did not improve since then, and his father went through a lot of effort to find a nursing home-type facility for him, a group home in Madison, so that Paul could actually get out and die not in prison with his family around. Unfortunately for him, he died last year in prison.
Can you talk about the expense of older prisoners and prisoners with serious health conditions?
There are a lot of different studies about the cost of incarceration for older prisoners. The Department of Corrections tells me that they don't differentiate the cost to take care of an older prisoner versus a younger prisoner, but they are looking into trying to build a $7 million facility to care for sick and elderly prisoners. And then also, there have been several studies done about this that put the cost of taking care of an elderly prisoner at between 2 and 9 times the cost of taking care of a younger prisoner. So the average annual cost of housing someone in prison in Wisconsin is $35,000. So double that is $70,000. And if you do the 9 times that, it's $300 and change.
looking at the numbers under this, what's called the Compassionate Release Program, it isn't used very often at all, right?
It really isn't. And I did a survey of all 50 states and asked them about their programs, and I found that not only does Wisconsin not use compassionate release very often, but really there is no state that uses it very often. I believe the state with the highest number of releases in 2015, which was the year that I collected data from, was Texas, and they had released 85 people. But Texas, as you know, has a large population and also has quite a lot more prisoners than many of the other states.
So why, not just Wisconsin, why in so many states is this used so rarely?
You know, that is an excellent question. I talked to some experts, and they gave several different reasons. One of them, and the first one that would come to most people's mind, I'm sure, is that tough-on-crime policies don't want, and people who espouse those types of policies don't want to let criminals out early for any reason. So somebody like Paul Echols, I can certainly see how people in law enforcement would not want someone who shot at the police to get out of prison early, no matter what condition he's in. However, when they denied his release, they said it was because he was a danger to society, and a risk to society still at this point. So what I don't understand about that is just, if the reason is that you don't want to release somebody who shot at police, which is a perfectly valid position, then say that. So anyway, that's one reason. Another reason is that it is hard to find places that will take former prisoners, especially people who have been convicted of violent felonies. Throughout the country, it's hard to find nursing homes and places like that that are willing to accept former prisoners.
We're talking with Gina Barton, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's law enforcement investigative reporter. We're talking about the compassionate release program in Wisconsin prisons and around the country, and why they're not used very often. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the state should allow more inmates early release and or parole, depending on their current status, talking about in particular elderly inmates or inmates with serious health conditions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Gina Barton is with us, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's law enforcement investigative reporter, talking about her piece called Release Programs for Sick and Elderly Prisoners Could Save Millions, but States Rarely Use Them. We're talking about what's going on in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of compassionate release for inmates who are older, over 60, or have serious health conditions? Good idea, bad idea? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I firmly believe in this, and I think that if a family member is willing to assume this liability and responsibility, it should be mandatory that they be released. Cindy, we're spending far too much money on prisons and too little money on education and training programs for people that need jobs.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call. And Gina, Cindy does raise a next question. What happens if a prisoner leaves, an inmate leaves, they have serious health problems? What do they do next?
And that's a really good question. A lot of them do want to live with family members, as Cindy mentioned. A lot of them in other states, such as some on the East Coast, they have special facilities where people can be paroled directly to a nursing home facility or that sort of thing. The other thing that has come up is, well, taxpayers are paying for prisons, but if these people get out and they go on Medicaid, Medicare, aren't the taxpayers still paying for them? And the answer to that is yes, but they're going to be paying a lot less because you're not having to pay for security and transportation of disabled people. Even if somebody is in a wheelchair or is clearly unable to escape from prison, when they go for medical testing, they have to be accompanied by security. And even when Nancy Ezell had her mastectomy, there was an armed guard in the room with her 24 hours at the hospital. So those kinds of costs you wouldn't need for people once they got out.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cindy. And you also write, Gina, about some of the conditions facing older inmates, inmates with serious health problems. Prison is not a great place for them to be in a lot of ways.
No, it really isn't. And one of the experts I talked to talked a lot about people with dementia, Alzheimer's, those sort of aging symptoms, and things that might not be their fault can end up getting them in trouble. So if somebody with dementia keeps asking questions or acts out or, you know, shouts angry things at a guard, you know, these might be things that are actually symptoms of their disease, but they're going to be viewed as an infraction or a broken rule.
Gina, as we start to wrap up, there's been a lot of talk about various kinds of correctional reform in the country when it comes to things like sentencing. Is this issue of compassionate release, has this been a big part of the conversation?
I think it's becoming a part of the conversation. Just today, David Bowen and a couple of other legislators had asked for a committee hearing or a public hearing on some rule changes at the Department of Corrections around this issue. And also the Pew Center, which is a national advocacy group, is going to be having a meeting with some legislators nationally in the coming weeks to discuss this issue.
We'll leave it there for now. Gina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Gina Barton, law enforcement reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. She joined us to talk about early release programs for elderly or severely ill prison inmates. Every year or so, it seems, there's a date that one group of people is sure marks the end of the world. Some have tragic results, such as the Heaven's Gate Doomsday Cult. Others pass with an adjustment by the leader that, in fact, there was a miscalculation. There's a different end-of-the-world day to plan for. Might seem like a modern phenomenon, but in fact, hoaxes have been a big part of history practically as long as humans have. The first end-of-the-world prediction that we know of took place in 2800 BC. Ian Tattersall is a curator emeritus in the Division of Anthropology of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, where he co-curates the Spitzer Hall of Human Origins. He and his co-author, Peter Navremont, have traced the history of these stories, a lot of different hoaxes and fake beliefs, in their new book, Hoax, A History of Deception, 5,000 Years of Fakes, Forgeries, and Fallacies. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, happy to be here.
Well, your day job, Ian, is presenting a lot of real stuff at a major museum. What got you into studying all this fake stuff?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, I'm a scientist by trade, and you know, normally the stuff that I write has got a sort of a serious scientific component to it. And I think this is the first book I ever did purely for fun, because there is a sort of this element of quirkiness in human history that we don't really pay a lot of attention to, but really it tells us a lot about ourselves when we actually look at it.
And why are we so susceptible to hoaxes? Sometimes the same hoax is going on for hundreds or even thousands of years.
Yeah, all the good ones run forever. No question about it. And I think that, but, you know, they are sort of out of the usual. And I think if one thing has sort of emerged from this new hoax culture that has been emerging in recent months, it's that what we respond to is the novel. We love news stories. And, of course, a hoax can be an old hoax, but it can be a new thing for every generation. And so we're used to hearing basically the same historical story over and over again. And then when we hear something new, something out of the ordinary, we respond to it.
And it seems like these things spread really well today on the Internet and social media, but we didn't need the Internet or social media to have hoaxes.
No, we didn't. No, we didn't. But it's really extraordinary, I find, that this book that we've just written was sort of conceived in a different world than the one that it was born into. We now sort of have a default assumption that all news is fake news, or at least to be viewed with some kind of skepticism, whereas previously we thought if we're getting news from a usually reliable source, we could usually rely on the news.
I want to get into a few of the, I think you've got 50 different examples of historical hoaxes in the book, historical and modern day, I should say. And I wanted to start with breatharianism, this idea that people can live without food or water just by breathing, and I think maybe some sunlight. I had seen news stories about people making this claim last year. The debunking site Snopes.com had a file on it, but this goes back much further than that.
Yes, indeed, and all kinds of sort of fad diets and so on go back a very long way. But this idea that you can live on the breath of God alone, which is where this this notion of breatharianism comes from, is actually a fairly recent one. It's been claimed way back into history that people could live without food. But the whole idea of breatharianism is that the breath of God is enough, and that you don't need even water under this notion. And that was first put about by a German Catholic nun called Therese Neumann back in the 1920s. And it was an extreme version of this sort of ability to live without no food kind of diet, which essentially, in principle, eliminated the body taking in anything but air.
And people have been making this claim on and off since then, and there have been efforts to debunk, to show that, to find out that in one case, this person had a fridge full of food.
Oh, that's right. I mean, there's been plenty of cases where people have sort of been caught in the act. There was a guy called Wiley Brooks, who was the president of the Breatharian Institute of America, who was once allegedly seen leaving a 7-Eleven with a hot dog and a Diet Coke and Twinkies. So we can't necessarily believe that breatharians practice what they preach.
Why would this one catch on? Because it seems pretty clear, and the evidence would stack up against you pretty quickly. If you live a long time without taking in nutrients or even water, things will go poorly.
That's a really, really good question. And why people should want to adhere to this kind of belief is, it's nothing short of mind-boggling. But if you really do adhere to this belief, it's fatal. I mean, there was a case not that long ago where a follower of an Australian breatharian called Jas Muheen actually starved to death by the side of a lake, having recorded in her diary that this was her belief.
We are talking to Ian Tattersall, co-author of the new book, Hoax, A History of Deception. He's curator in the Museum of Natural History in New York in the anthropology department there. And Ian, I want to move on to another example. This one, in a good thriller fiction book, we love a conspiracy theory. Dan Brown talked about this one, but it has a real-world adherence to this idea of something called the Priory of Sion. Can you talk about that?
Yes, indeed. Actually, the Priory of Sion itself has a disappointingly short history. Of course, the whole conceit of the Dan Brown book goes right back to Jesus and the marriage of Jesus and to Mary Magdalene, and then Mary going to France and giving rise to the Merovingian dynasty, and so on and so on and so on. But this is basically a story that was concocted really back in its full form, back in the 1960s. And so it doesn't go back a terribly long way.
And so talk about the origin of this story. Why did someone make this up, and why did it catch on?
Well, it goes back to a time when the priest in the village of Rennes-le-Château in southern France began reconstructing his dilapidated church using funds that he apparently got from trafficking in masses, which was sort of selling masses for the souls of the departed, which was very much frowned on by the Catholic authorities. But during this process of reconstruction, he found ancient documents that apparently bore evidence or documentary evidence of this marriage of Jesus and the history subsequently of his offspring. And local tradition had it that it was this money that we're paying for the renovations. And then a guy called Noel Corbu came into possession of this priest's residence and tried to turn it into a hotel. And a good selling point for the hotel, of course, was this this local legend of the involvement of the Merovingian dynasty. And then Corbu later on met a guy called Pierre Anatas Marie Pontard, who was a sort of a grifter who, in the 1930s and the 1940s, founded a number of sort of right-wing extremist groups in France. And these cliques that he set up became increasingly esoteric until in 1956, Pontard set up this grouping that he called the Priory of Sion, which he named for a local landmark. And it never really got very much traction, and eventually Pontard went to jail for child abuse. Now, then in the 1960s, Pontard was out of jail. He met Corbu. And by 1964, he was ready to remanufacture the Priory of Sion to his own advantage, and he manufactured this history of the Priory going back all the way to the Crusades. So a very long history based on this earlier tradition from Rennes Le Château.
That fits. This all fits in, the fact that this caught on and then ended up in a novel and movies with Dan Brown. You know, you mentioned earlier, we know the history, we keep hearing, it seems commonplace, we learned it in school, we learned it in church. Oh, here's this intriguing alternate story. That's why something like this might be appealing to people?
Well, I think so. I think people are naturally attracted, as I mentioned before, by the unusual, by new twists on things. But whenever you see a new twist, you have to ask yourself, where did that new twist come from? And in this case, the new twist came from an entirely fabricated history that was made by this this con man back in the essentially in the 1950s.
Let's jump to another story. We've been hearing people online in particular, again, making claims that the Earth is not a spherical shape. It is, in fact, a flat. And this goes way back. But ancient Greeks were already figuring out, right, that the Earth was globe-shaped. So why are we still having this argument today?
Well, another very, very good question. And I think sort of each of these vignettes into these strange things that people will believe sort of has its own moral and speaks for itself. In this case, it's very hard to know why there was this resistance. You know, Aristotle had already shown that in classical times that as a ship sailed over the horizons, its masts would be the last thing that disappeared from view, and that the Earth cast a spherical kind of or a curved kind of a shadow on the moon during an eclipse and so on. Everybody sort of basically took for granted that the world was a globe, and Columbus knew the world was a globe when he set off on his voyages. And why people want to believe otherwise is something that I can only speculate about. And I come back always to the fact that if it's possible to think somebody out there is thinking it. You know, and there's a lot of people in the world. And therefore, a lot of, potential believers of very strange things.
Well, it's interesting to think that, you know, as people are tweeting things on their phone about a flat Earth, in many cases, that tweet is going up into a series of satellites that go around the globe. It's kind of counterintuitive.
That's right. The rapper B.O.B. was a famous tweeter of flat Earth beliefs. And he says, there's no way that you can see all the evidence and not know. while again, yeah, he's taking advantage of all this this satellite technology that depends on the Earth being a globe. Another of those cool ironies of human existence.
Ian, as we wrap up, you've written about 50 different hoaxes or type of hoaxes here. Mm-hmm. Is it your hope that by talking about them, you can help to debunk them, at least for some people?
Well, we're hoping that that people will read what we have written on these 50 different fakes, frauds, and fallacies, and draw their own conclusions. This is kind of a fun book. I hope it's as easy to read as it was fun to actually write it, and that we can give people a chance just to draw their own conclusions from presenting what we know about these 50 different, mainly disreputable episodes of human history.
Ian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Ian Tattersall is a curator emeritus in the Division of Anthropology of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. He co-curates the Spitzer Hall of Human Origins there. He joins us to talk about some of the stories in his new book, Hoax, A History of Deception, 5,000 Years of Fakes, Forgeries, and Fallacies.